Hi there and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years and I'm fascinated by how the companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado to today's episode, and we've got a tasty one for you. The Keogh family have been farming in North County Dublin for over 200 years, growing fresh produce, particularly potatoes, and supplying the local markets. As part of the farming community for generations, being a good neighbour and supporting local communities is a very important part of the Keogh family ethos. Sitting in front of me is Tom Keogh, director of the family business, who has guided through considerable industry challenges to become one of Ireland's most esteemed fresh produce businesses. Tom is dedicated to working alongside and supporting community initiatives, driving positive changes to help build brighter futures. The other hat that Tom wears is founder and managing director of Keogh's Crisps, a premium snack food manufacturer employing 150 people. Founded in 2011, Keogh's have grown to become one of Ireland's most popular food brands, exporting to 20 countries. Tom's passion for quality, superior taste, innovation and efficient marketing have resulted in Keogh's achieving considerable market share in an industry dominated by powerful multinational competitors. Keogh's Crisps has seen phenomenal growth in the last year, both in Ireland and in the markets overseas. Tom, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Delighted to be here, Aidan. Great. Thank you very much.
Delighted to have you.
I think that intro was fantastic. I might actually rob that document off you on the way out the door.
That's no problem at all. No, we don't copyright anything around here. Let's talk about the family business first,
yeah.
Right? Long history, great legacy in the area. You know, take me through it and the how different the business is today, even, say, a decade ago, two decades ago.
Yeah. So I'll bring it way back. So, you know, the family are out in North County Dublin. The earliest document we have of us farming and the family farm where it is today is 1833. There's a tithes or a land tax paid to the local church for the land. But the gravestones in the area go back way beyond that, you know, 1700s, 1600s, etc. So we're there a long, long time. North County Dublin is Market Gardening Central. And basically my family, if you could grow it in our soils, in our climate, and sell it at a profit into the local markets in Dublin City, that's what we've done, yeah, for hundreds of years. And over the years, you name it, if it could be grown in this climate, and in some cases, sometimes we couldn't grow it in this climate, we've tried it, and it just wouldn't work. So, for example, I spent 5 years trying to grow Irish popcorn, believe it or not, and that didn't work out. But yeah, that's what we've done for generations. When my grandfather, his story, like back in the 1950s, I think 1957, 1958 were the two wettest years on record in Ireland before 2012. So some meteorological records, but his crops failed for 2 years on the trot. And he actually ended up emigrating out of Ireland. He went to Australia. I think there was a shilling ticket or there was a name on a cheap ticket that they were trying to populate Australia at the time.
Ryanair of the day.
Yeah, on a boat and off he went. So Grandad was forced to leave. He went to Australia. And believe it or not, he was working in Adelaide. And I myself ended up travelling and working in Adelaide in my early 20s. And I didn't know this story at the time. But my granddad was there. And when he was in Australia trying to earn a few quid, he came across a tomato in the late 1950s. And back then, a tomato was not something you found in the supermarkets weren't even opened. Fergal Quinn would eventually open the first supermarket in Ireland in the 60s. So Grandad came back with this idea to grow tomatoes. I didn't realise, but in Adelaide, actually Adelaide was mainly populated by Italians. So hence the cuisine in the area was dictated obviously by the core ingredient, which was tomatoes. Mm-hmm. So Grandad came home, had a great idea. He had a few quid in his back pocket and he built a glasshouse and he started growing tomatoes. And very, very exotic fruit at the time. Started supplying them into Fergal Quinn, believe it or not. He was opening a few local supermarkets around North County Dublin. Yeah. And that's what got Grandad started on, I suppose, differentiating himself from everything else, which was in the market. And so that he built an incredible industry. I remember being a kid running around the glasshouses, and there was, you know, there was speakerphones and stuff around the, so everybody could communicate to each other and this type of stuff. So quite advanced, and that grew considerably until the 70s when the fuel crisis in the 70s really put a ceiling on the growth opportunities there, because the cost of production went through the roof. And at that stage, the Spanish had really got their act in gear around all this glasshouse production, etc., supplying it up into Northern Europe, so we couldn't compete. So the tomatoes fell to one side. Cucumbers, I remember them. And then my dad and my uncle had obviously come into the business at that stage, and they really grew a lot of brassicas. So cabbage, cauliflower, sprouts, very, very big sprout growers. And believe it or not, I remember broccoli being grown on the farm as this very new, innovative brassica, this new thing called broccoli. Wow, you know, and
it was in there. How are we going to sell this? I don't know. Let's grow it first.
yeah. So that was, say, 80s into the 90s. And again, that whole industry, cheap imports coming in from the UK, really, really destroyed that whole brassica industry here. And even today, it's just a fraction of what it was many years ago. So very, very difficult to make money there. Potatoes were always part of what we did.
Right.
And a potato crop, you can only really grow a potato crop in land maybe 1 year in four, 1 year in five. So we were using potatoes as that 1 year in five rotation with the brassicas and with the cereals, etc. But they were always part of what we did. And my dad, back in the early 1990s, two bits of innovation that really changed what we did dramatically. Number one, Dad bought, it sounds so simple, but he bought a potato washer and started washing potatoes. And today, like, people don't understand, but you used to not be able to get potatoes washed. And it was a massive innovation. It sounds so simple, but it was a huge innovation at the time. And my father was actually one of the first people to adopt that technology and start washing potatoes.
Yeah, and the Gen Zers would have a stroke now if they imagined going into the supermarket and the potatoes still had the muck on them.
I know. What would you do? Take the brush out. But the other innovation was cold storage. And cold storage came into the market. I think Dad built his first cold store, Dad and Tony, around 1992. And what that did, it took an industry whereby you would harvest your potatoes in August, September, October. You would basically put them in big stacks in a shed, cover them in straw, blow air through them at night and try to keep them fresh. And no matter what you did, by the time the ambient temperature started to increase in March and April, your crop, you'd start to lose your crop. So it was a very, very seasonal business. Whereas cold storage came in, and basically what that meant was you harvest your potatoes August, September, October. They go into wooden boxes. They're stored in a cold room with air circulating correctly and all the, there's a lot of management around it. But it basically means that you can hold your crop for 365 days a year. So that went from a very seasonal business to a daily business. And Dad basically stored the potatoes, grew the potatoes, stored the potatoes, washed the potatoes, put them into these little bags and delivered them into the corporation fruit markets in Smithfield and Dublin City Centre there. And that's what we did every morning, year round, day in, day out. And that was a great little business Dad had built up there. Peter Keogh and Sons was the brand, my grandfather and his two sons. And great reputation for just supplying really, really good, high quality product day in, day out into the market. And I suppose there's, you know, what we've found is that we can produce a fantastic product where we are out in North County Dublin. About 64% of all the fruit and vegetables for Ireland are actually grown, produced, or packed in that area. And there's a number of reasons for that. I suppose number one is the climate. It's the driest area in Ireland, which doesn't say a whole lot from a global context. But in Ireland,
and neither in the context of the last month of February.
No, we've had it up to here with rain. But it's relatively dry, and we get the rain at the right time. So during the summer months, when the crop is bulking up, we need about an inch of rain residual moisture in the land. And generally, we tend to get it in the heavy soils in North County Dublin. we also have incredible sunlight in this country, and people don't respect that here. We don't realize how lucky we are with the sunlight. Mm. Like, it can be during the summer, it can be bright at 4:30 a.m. Mm. Doesn't get dark till 11 o'clock at night. You know, it's so incredible growth in this country around fresh produce. The soils are incredibly good, and over the generations, having Dublin City beside us meant that the expertise was built up over generations and generations. So it's kind of the perfect situation to actually develop this fantastic raw material. So fast track then to, I think, when did I come out? Around 1999, 2000, I came in to start to work in the family business, and unfortunately, the landscape were changing dramatically. So we had first of all, the markets were changing. Mm. So whereas my father and his father would have went into Dublin City Centre and sold their wares in the market, you know, a bustling market, early every morning, all your business would be done before 6 a.m, you know, and you'd be home for breakfast. Whereas those markets were disappearing. And what was happening was you had basically centralization of buying. So let's say a retailer like Musgraves, Supervalue and Centra, whereby there could have been maybe 200 independent stores that all bought and sold that, for themselves. Now, all of a sudden, they were being consolidated, and there was one person buying for that entire group. And instead of delivering to a market, you were delivering to a big central distribution centre on the outskirts of Dublin somewhere. So the markets were changing, and the purchasing of products was completely moving from the traditional methods to new centralized buying, number one. And then number two, we had a massive issue with consumption on fresh potatoes. And to give you an idea, Borbia have the figures there. I think between 2000 and 2010, we had an almost 50% reduction in consumption of fresh potatoes in this country. And it's shocking when you think about it. Like, there's no other fruit product it happened to, but the poor old potato was falling off the national plate. And there was a number of reasons that happened. First of all, we had, if you think about what happened to this country, the people in this country in that time, we became very affluent. Mm. Now, we lost it all again at the back end of it, but we did become very affluent. And we started to travel, and our diet started to change. Mm. So all of a sudden, the potato had a competitor in pasta and rice for the national evening dinner. And we obviously started to lose out in potato consumption as a result. Number two was there was an anti-carb movement. Mm. If we remember the Atkins diet, back in the early 2000s, there was a big kickback against carbohydrates. And that had a big impact. And then we had a huge image issue. So we had, and I remember being in a focus group one time asking consumers about, you know, why aren't you eating potatoes? And I remember this young girl, you know, early 20s, perfect target market for us. You know, these are the people we want to be eating our products. And she said, but I'd never eat a potato. That's something my grandparents used to eat. You know, so it was just seen as a very old traditional Irish food, you know, with the era of the famine and old Ireland. So we had a massive image issue, and then we had a big convenience issue. So look, pretty much any potato dish you were going to cook took between 30 and 45 minutes. So it was just falling out of the kitchen as well. So that, I suppose, there were the challenges, I suppose, my generation was facing coming into the family business. And we set about tackling those. And I suppose the first thing we needed to do was we needed to be able to communicate to a consumer. And without having a brand, you know, and a notable brand in the marketplace, that was really difficult to do. Potatoes were being used as a loss leader and a footfall driver in retailers all over Ireland. So what we did was we said we'd set about trying to develop this brand that would enable us to deliver a product that could compete with pasta and rice for consistency and for convenience, etc. And the main thing was the consistent quality, which was really, really hard to achieve in such a fresh product.
Right, yeah.
And that's where the Kyo brand was actually developed originally for potatoes. Lots of innovation back then. We were the first people in the world to develop easy cook potatoes. This is a little potato bag that can actually cook in the microwave.
Yeah.
And you throw it in the microwave, 7 minutes, boom, potatoes are cooked. So tick, box, convenience issue.
Yeah.
And, you know, we marketed that in UCD and Trinity and all the colleges and trying to get kids back eating potatoes again. And it started to work. the branding, I suppose notoriety around the family brand, that was a slower sell. You know, that would come into us later in years. But the convenience, the quality, what we did around the everyday consistent delivery of a high quality product to consumer, that really did start to resonate. And you know, we were looking at about between 11 and 17% consumption reductions every year. And after a number of years, the retailers that we actually dealt with, that started to completely reverse when actually potatoes started to become convenient, become relevant, and become marketed to a consumer. We're the first people to market potatoes to an Irish consumer. So that worked really well. Mm-hmm. And eventually that would lead to the snack food brand that I suppose everybody knows in the country today.
Would you say it's better? Would you say the Kyo's brand is better known as a snack food or as with the potatoes?
Oh, it's crisps.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah. Like people,
so do you think people go, oh yeah, that's the crisp guys who do potatoes as well?
Well, everybody says it to me. God, I didn't realise you guys actually did potatoes as well. I said, God, that's that's where we came from. The whole potato crisp idea came again around that time, the early 2000s, and there was a lot of really cool trends happening in food. And the first one really was around provenance. Mm-hmm. People started becoming really, really interested in where their food came from, yeah, and the people behind their food, and that was one of the key insights behind the Kyo brand when we developed for potatoes. And when we developed that for potatoes, literally each family member had a pack, you know, and our face was on the back of that bag. And that was the first time that was ever done in fresh produce, to actually put a farmer behind the product that they were actually making and market that to the consumer. And it was so new and so innovative at the time. I was so embarrassed to have my face on a potato bag. And you'd get phone calls and your friends would meet you and they'd be slagging you, oh, I see you in my fridge, you know, this type of stuff. But today...
But now you see it like from meat to mushrooms to potatoes to everything.
Yeah, right. Everything.
But is it ultimately, it was the reason that was necessitated was because, like in the old days when you were going into Smithfield Market, everybody knew your family, right? And therefore you knew your market. But then when you went to a centralised purchase hub for Musgraves or whoever, it didn't really matter who you were. They were just, there was one person, bought them all and then just shipped it through.
Yeah, but I suppose it's also about the evolving consumer. And the consumer, for some reason, started to really take an interest in where their food came from and the people behind it. So being able to market ourselves to that insight really, really helped. And that was a massive trend that I could see that as a family business, we were very, very strong in. And the thing is that we had competitors trying to make up these stories, whereas ours was true.
Yeah.
Then you had this, the other trend was this whole premiumization in food, whereby, you know, pre say 2010, you would have maybe one type of chocolate biscuit sold in a retailer. Whereas after that, all of a sudden we seen there was a value range of chocolate biscuit, there was a mid range of chocolate biscuit, and there was a really, really fancy range of chocolate biscuits. Potato crisps were exactly the same. And we started to see this premiumization in potato crisps, where you'd have this hand-cooked, very, very high-quality seasonings, very high-quality oils, delivering
this unusual flavouring combination.
Exactly, delivering this quite high-quality product into the market. And I suppose what I didn't like at the time is when I started to see this emerge, they were all imported brands coming into Ireland that were being supplied into the Irish retailers. So I said, okay, this is a good opportunity for us. So we'll utilise the family brand. We utilise the trend around the premiumisation. And guess what? We have all this incredible raw material back on the farm.
Yeah.
So back in 2011, I set about setting up. I literally took an old potato store on the farm. I kitted it all out, turned it into a high-care production facility. I bought my first little fryer from an Amish community in Pennsylvania, little 40-year-old fryer, and set it up back on the farm. And I literally started off with a bucket of potatoes, a little slicer, tiny little fryer, a little seasoning drum, and a bagger at the other side. And that got me going. Mm. And, you know, incredibly, from day one, we just started making this incredibly great-tasting product. And it was as much as an accident as it was designed,
right, yeah.
Because I didn't have the knowledge to really get into the science and everything of it. We just played around with different oils, different temperatures, different seasonings on the farm, and got to something that we all thought, God, that tastes really nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder what the consumer will think. Then nobody would buy them. Making them was the easy bit. It's always to learn, and then, God, trying to sell them, this is the hard bit. I didn't realise what a competitive space I was trying to get into. Mm. And as I can see today, it literally is the most competitive space in the whole of food retail and snack foods. So it was literally us against at that time, Tato was Irish owned. Today it's not, but it was us against Tato and Walkers. Yeah. You know, that was it. And of course, I didn't understand how retail really worked. You know, that, hold on, they actually own that shelf there. You really can't put your product there. You can't just put your product over there. So I wasn't getting a break. Mm. Wasn't getting a break at all. And to be fair, at the time, we were supplying potatoes into Superquinn. And the Superquinn wouldn't even buy the crisps, and I was shocked. You know, why God, surely that, but they weren't. And I remember one day I was doing an emergency delivery of potatoes, believe it or not, into the Superquinn in Lucan, and the snack food buyer happened to walk around the corner, and there was me in a van horsing out all these potatoes onto a pallet to bring into the supermarket. And I think he took pity on me. He said, "Tom, what are you going to do with these crisps?" I said, "Well, you know, they're there. If you want them, you know, I'd be happy to supply." And he says, "Go on, listen, we'll list you." And that was it. That was my first little listing with Superquinn. And when I then started to supply Superquinn, nobody was buying anything because there was actually no space in the shelf to put my product.
Yeah.
So first little bit of luck was that I knew all the fresh produce buyers in all the Superquinn stores, fresh produce managers in all the Superquinn stores. And I went into the stores and I asked them, "Do you mind if I built a little wooden stand here and put it beside our potatoes in the fresh produce section and stacked it with crisps, would that be okay?" And we had such a good relationship. They said, yeah, far ahead, Tom. So I went around all the Superquinn stores and I put in all these wooden stands with Kyo's crisps beside the Kyo's potatoes. And what an absolute marketing coup. Mm. Because there you had the raw material from the family, you had the cooked crisps from the family side by side in the store. And it completely clicked. To a point that I remember meeting the buyer for a meeting, and about 9 months later, we had run a promotion and we had got end of aisle shelves and shelf space. And we were the second highest turning over promotion in that store, only second to Coca-Cola, after 9 months, which was an incredible success. But it was the power of the marketing. The pricing was right, and the quality.
You also never looked at it like traditionally people would have gone into that and gone, "Okay, well, I've got two big competitors. How do I beat the competitor?" You actually didn't, in a way, you didn't focus on the competitor.
No.
You just said, I need to think about getting space here. How do I get space differently than, you know, if it was somebody else's brand going in?"
That was it. And they were in the fresh produce section, all the crisps, and they sold well, and we got to a point where we were our rate of sale was so successful that the buyer had no choice. He had to put us on the main shelf, you know, because we were delivering for them. And in a retail supermarket, in a supermarket, every square foot of space has to deliver.
The big question then, I suppose, is were people very confused when he did put them into the main space for you and they were going, oh, no, they're always beside the potatoes. Where are the crisps going?
Well, it's good because what happens in those situations is the best thing, you try to hold on to both. You try to hold on to both because every bit of space in a supermarket is... Very important.
Going back to the other thing I always wondered about, when you're talking about, the drive to convenience and yet you then had to change the product in terms of the bag and things like that. Did that mean then that there was a big loss of the variety of potatoes that were available on the market? Because there was probably only certain types of potatoes that suited the convenient tag and things like that. Like, we look now and I remember growing up and you'd be going into the shop, there was probably about 20 different varieties of potatoes.
Yeah.
Now most places you only go into the three. Maybe.
Yeah. And it's right that was happened over the years. And, you know, some of the varieties, they've been incredibly successful and rightly so because of what they can actually deliver to the consumer. But like back in the early days, varieties like Record. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't even hear of a Record today.
Cares Pink.
We do sell Cares Pink, but believe it or not, like you could nearly develop a map of Ireland over potato varieties.
Okay.
Cares Pink is a west of Ireland, south of Ireland.
Okay.
Yeah, Golden Wonder is west of Ireland and southeast. We sell quite a lot of Golden Wonder down there. Our Leinster is Rooster. Rooster Central. Well, Rooster today is about 62% of total market sales is Rooster. It's an Irish variety. It was bred by a man called Harry Keogh, no relation, down in Chagas and O'Park, County Carlow. And believe it or not, Rooster was, and we have the original breeding sheets for Rooster, it was bred as a crisping potato. Yeah. Okay. And you cannot make a crisp out of Rooster.
Yeah, I was going to ask you.
No, you can't. And I've tried many a time, but no, it never works out. Never works out. Doesn't make a great crisp at all. But it is an incredible eating potato. And the beauty about Rooster is it is so versatile. Mm. Basically, you can buy it in the supermarket, bring it home, and you can nearly cook any dish. Any dish, where there's very few potato varieties you can do that with.
And what's the best variety for the crisp?
Oh, believe it or not, it depends on the time of year.
Okay.
And that was one of the, I suppose, getting into such a competitive category, like how do you win? So when you look at, our assets, what could we bring here? It was the potato know-how.
Right.
And that potato know-how led to a much higher quality product. And we know these varieties, we know how they perform throughout the year. So we will use certain varieties at certain times of the year when they're in their actual optimum for
cooking.
The
crisp I get in a kiosk in March is not the same potato that I might get in June or August or September.
No, completely different. It's a fairly basic one, but there's very few potato varieties you can actually harvest and crisp on the same day or within, say, 3 or 4 days. There's a variety called Lady Rosetta. It's an early variety, but we harvest that in August. And most of the days it's actually back to the factory and it's crisped within 1 or 2 days. It's one of the only varieties that will allow you to do that. If I took, say, a variety called Lady Clare, which we might use maybe in April or May, and I did the same, it would be a horrible, curled up, oily, soaky crisp with very little texture. So it's about knowing when is the best time to actually use that actually potato variety.
Did you view the two businesses as completely separate, or are they ultimately entwined?
It's slightly different ownership in the family. Obviously the snack food business is more focused on the new generation, the younger generation, and the family business was my father and my uncle. They were obviously owners of that. They transferred it when they retired, only a couple of years ago. But are still working harder than ever on the farm. They probably will never really retire. So obviously they're two separate businesses from legal entity point of view. But of course, there's incredible synergies across the board.
Yeah. And do you have a favourite child?
As in businesses?
Yeah.
Oh, well, one of the reasons why I started the snack food business was because it's a bit of fun.
Yeah.
It's a bit of crack, you know, compared to the farming business, which, listen, I love to farm. There's nothing makes me happier than jumping up in a tractor and disappearing off for an afternoon. But, you know, being able to, I suppose the snack food business is more of a challenging business and it allows you to develop your skills across the board, you know, from sitting here talking to somebody like you to, you know, working a welder tomorrow morning trying to fix a machine to, you know, being overseas trying to market your product to overseas consumers. It's a business that has, it's so broad ranging that, you know, I enjoy every single area of it.
Talk to me about intergenerational business conflicts, because as you said, your uncle and your father have retired, but not really retired. So they're still going around. Like, when you came up with the idea that said, I've got a great one, that's crisps, right?
Yeah.
What was the reaction?
I'm probably coming up with 10 ideas a week.
Right,
you know, so it was like, oh, here we go again. It was interesting at the time because when I did want to get into crisps, you know, when word got out there that this is the direction I wanted to take, I actually got a phone call from Tato at the time.
Okay.
Don't do that. Yeah, we'll make them for you. Yeah. And thankfully, I didn't go down that route at the time and ended up building my own little factory, and off he went. Because I knew back then, even though that they could make them probably cheaper than I'd be able to make them, I'd never be differentiated.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd never be able to
you
actually...
You wouldn't have control over the quality, you wouldn't have control over, you know, the branding, everything would be always...
Exactly. And you know what, there's something in that for food entrepreneurs, especially young food entrepreneurs today. There are so many people out there that... they'll develop a really cool looking brand, you know, amazing packaging, and then they'll go to a big, you know, industrial box manufacturer to say,
make that
for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, consumers are not silly.
Mm.
You know, at the end of the day, the human tongue is the most sensitive thing in the planet, you know, and they know that your product is not any different than that product or that product. And if you're trying to ask for more money for the consumer from that, you know, there's a shelf life on that. That's not going to work out. Mm. So you really need to deliver and differentiate your product from a taste and quality point of view.
And as you look now for the snack food business, what's the scope for non-crisp innovation?
it's there. Our first move outside of crisps was popcorn back in 2018. And, you know, that was a really important one for me because I wasn't sure if that family potato brand and family potato crisp brand had the permission from the Irish consumer to actually extend outside of a potato-based product. So that was our first go at that. And we did a lot of consumer research at the time. And I remember what came back from the Irish consumers. It was sort of, okay, so Kyo's are getting into popcorn. Okay, why this could be good. But I would be so disappointed if I tasted that product and it didn't stand up to the quality, taste, and consistency that I enjoy from the potato crisp products.
Okay.
So the pressure was to deliver in that product. And we spent a lot of time trying to develop a popcorn product that was really high quality and very much differentiated in the market. And based on the market share we've got today and the growth that we're enjoying from that product, I think we've ticked those boxes.
But it is always a risk. And, you know, I've had other guests on in the past to say that kind of say, you know, just because you can put your name or your brand on a product doesn't mean you should put your brand on a product.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And to be fair, with the brand today, like it's the awareness of our brand, especially in Ireland, is very, very high. So we do get approached by a lot of people who want to do this product with our brand or this product or this product. And it's always a no. Mm. You know, basically where I've got to today, if I cannot control the manufacturing and every single aspect of that product by the time it gets to the consumer shelves, I'm not interested.
But also be able to add a differentiation from whatever else is on out there at the time.
Yeah, well, we will do that with our process.
Yeah.
But it has to be special. It has to be delivered for that KO brand.
I said in the intro, you know, that there's a very strong family ethos within the KO going back over. KO's going back over the legacy. Do you feel that's been carried through to the Chris brand, the business as well?
The family, yes. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I think one of the things that I always remember growing up on the family farm was that there was always this this stop-go point whereby a product need to be released to the market, need to be released to the customer. And having that control, that master quality control that you say, okay, that's not good enough. Like even yesterday morning, we decided we've launched a new flavor completely developed. Packaging is in, the season's in, the whole lot's in, first production run. And we tasted it. We said, you know what? That is not good enough. That's not a kid. That's not good enough for us. And much to the team's annoyance, it's like, no, stop. We're going back to the drawing board here. And, you know, that has huge implications because there's customers all over the world who have listed this product and want to sell it. And there's going to be a big zero in a sales gap, in a sales report. But it's not the right thing to do for us. And that product has now gone back to the drawing board. So it's for us being brought up in that environment was incredibly valuable. But then also having that family culture and trying to take what is this incredible family culture and then bring that across the board in a business that's growing quite rapidly. When we got to about, I think it was about 40 to 50 employees, I kind of recognized, hold on a sec, things are, you know, I'm not going to see that. Yeah. How do I actually try to fix that problem if I'm not around? And then it was, okay, we need to get good people in here to make some of these decisions, but we also need to get them thinking our way.
Yeah.
How do we do that? And I then spent a lot of time learning about company culture and how it's important and how it can be communicated across the business and, you know, from person to person. And we set about locking that in way back then. That was probably maybe 8 years ago now.
And what do you think is the essence of the culture in KO's business?
So we've distilled it down to four values, and it's number one is be hardworking. Yeah. Number two is be good natured. Mm-hmm. So it's basically just be nice to each other. Yeah. Number three is be ambitious. And then number four is be the best. So there are four values. Yeah. And everybody needs to live to them. And I'm quite happy that we've distilled our family culture down into those four.
Okay.
Yeah. And like I've had people in our business that have gone, God, be hardworking. Is that not, you know, that's a little bit too, you know. And I said, no. That's what we do.
If you ever worked on a farm, maybe it's hard work.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you're not going to roll your sleeves, you shouldn't be here.
Yeah.
You know, there's another road for you. Yeah. And we then align all the appraisals, everything in the business around those four values. And it's worked well. Today, we've over 200 people, between 200, 250 people working in across the different areas of the businesses. And, you know, they get it. And what also really helps is that, number one, there's still five family members, you know, around the business. You know, so everybody's looking at you. Everybody's seeing what you do and how you do it. And then we've got this incredible leadership team in the business around us as well. You know, and, you know, we're just so lucky to have these great people in the business with so much experience behind them as well.
And you know, the thing you mentioned about the new crisp that, you know, you then decide, no, they're not right, we stop. Do you think it is easier for you to make those decisions because it's a family business and you're not answering to a group of shareholders or a group of investors or a group of whatever?
Right? Yeah, 100%.
Right.
So there's advantages and disadvantages to that family business. And advantages are, I can walk into a room and make that call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't have to go through seven levels of bureaucracy in order to get that approved. It's like, I know that's wrong.
Yeah.
We're not doing it. Then when it comes to the pace of the business, and you know, people come into our business and just, oh my God, you know, maybe people come into our business from other food businesses, larger food businesses, etc. They're not used to the pace. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that pace comes from the decision making. So enabling very, very quick, very straightforward, simple decision making. You know, and what I find, you know, when I deal with other businesses, everybody's just afraid of covering their back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In my business, listen, make the mistake. It's okay. Make the mistake, learn from it, and move forward.
Yeah.
That's what it's about. And but just make these quick decisions. We're designing a new factory. Actually, so we're more than designing. It's opening in July, so we're well down.
I hope you're following along past design at this stage.
But you know, everybody on that project is just not used to just people coming in and saying yes or no. It's a simple answer. It's a yes or a no. It's not, oh, we're going to make that decision in 2 weeks' time, or we need to talk to these people or this people. It's yes or no. And then move quick. So, you know, I think that quick decision-making has definitely enabled the high growth rates we've had.
Yeah,
especially in the last 5-6 years.
So it's fast decision-making, but when it comes to decisions, your own decision-making, are you data-based or gut feel?
Both.
Okay.
Both. I remember being in, I was in Coca-Cola's offices in London a few years back, and I was up there. Data, they've incredible data and really great data people, but there's a big sign up on the wall and it says data has a better idea. And it's so right. And to be honest, in our business, I didn't have the data. Mm. So in the early days, I couldn't afford retail data. We couldn't get those insights. So it was all seat of the pants. Mm-hmm. I think this, I think that. Now I have all that data and I have a team of people that crunch it all together and say, okay, we should do this. Great. That's all there. But just recently, in the last couple of years, we started extracting all the data from all the manufacturing processes. So we have all that connected data coming in with the MSBI reports. That's incredible. You know, what you can see and what you can tell from that data. But you are right. You know, to be able to pull it all together, you know, and make that decision, it's good.
Mm.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it is ultimately good. Talk to me about, because we obviously, you know, when you look at the snack business and to a certain extent, the history within the fresh produce business, innovation has been very, very important, right? But how do you balance the need for innovation with the risk of getting distracted and going down cul-de-sacs that you shouldn't go down?
I'd rather launch a product and make the mistake and learn from it than spend 6 months stuck in data and insights trying to make a decision on what to do with that product. Mm. And I've been there several times and I've just said to the team, listen, just do it.
Mm.
If it doesn't work, fail fast, fail early, take it out. But just do it. And when you actually look at the cost to your business, you could spend €80,000 here on insights and research. Or you could actually spend 50,000 just getting the thing out to market.
And working out whether it works.
And make the mistake. Sometimes it's better just to put it out to the market. Yeah. Let the customer tell you.
Yeah. Well, on that point then, there is a thing there that customers are great at telling you what's wrong with a product, but not necessarily giving you the solutions or insights as to how to improve it. How do you balance that, you know, your own desire to have quality and things like that with waiting for the customer to tell you the quality isn't there?
Yeah, Paul, has worked for me over the years, and just back to that product that we actually stopped yesterday, I call it the kitchen table test. And what I will do is when we have a product that we say, okay, we've done a lot of work on this, we think this is now ready to go to market, I'll bring it home and I tell you, wife and kids, literally, I'll get as much information in 20 seconds. And
if there's anything left after 20 seconds, it may not be the best product if it's all gone.
And that's why that product was stopped yesterday.
Right.
Yeah, the kids didn't like it. Kids said, no, not mad about that. Yeah. Boom. Okay. Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Thanks very much.
Cheapest consultant you'll ever have.
Exactly. Exactly. But like, I suppose if you look at the other method, you know, there was a product we did years ago, and I'll give it as an example because it just shows you how you can be steered wrong from spending a lot of money on insights and data. Back it was organic potatoes and Superquinn. So there was organic potatoes where their sales were declining. Mm. Yeah. And we were asked, okay, could you look at this product and actually come up with a plan on how we're actually going to fix this issue about organic? It was organic fresh produce in general. Mm. Why aren't people buying more organics? So we took the potato and we said, okay, let's do all the research on this. So we talked to consumers and basically it came back and there was a number of things in it. Number one, okay, most of the organic products on our shelves actually come from overseas. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of them are actually come from Israel at the time, believe it or not. So the consumer wanted an Irish product, okay? So we went and got Irish potato growers to grow Irish organic potatoes. Tick box. Price. So we don't want to pay any more than regular product for our organic produce. Okay, price matched. Tick box. Packaging. We don't like any of this plastic packaging. We'd like something that's a lot more recyclable, etc. So paper bag.
Yeah.
Tick box. And the quality of the product, basically organic products, generally speaking, they're a lower quality than the standard products. So we put a lot of work into improving the quality of the product. Tick the box. Okay, so Kyo's organic Irish potatoes were born, put on the shelf, and absolutely nothing happened with the sales. Mm. And that was, the consumer basically developed that product, and they didn't buy it.
Yeah.
So you just have to have that gut behind it as well to try help steer.
Yeah.
Yeah. If data and insights cannot just bring something all the way.
I get the sense anyway, but this the Kyo story always was, and by the sounds of it always will be, much more of an organic growth one rather than an acquired growth one.
True. Yes.
Going forward the same?
Unless there was something that was very, very, very much aligned. I can see today that the equity we've built up in our business around people, systems and processes, that there's certain businesses that if we took the Kyo way and applied them to, I think we could add huge value. Mm-hmm. So there may be opportunities there in the future, but at the moment there's nothing that's clear.
And will the Kyo brand always be in the Kyo family?
That would be my intention.
Right.
So that it's an important question because that steers everything. Mm. You know, so, you know, most entrepreneurs, when they're looking, you know, what is success?
Mm.
And, you know, if you really dig deep down, you know, what do you really want out of this? And people say, oh God, I want to make money.
Mm.
Great. What happens after you make money? You know, what's the next step?
Mm.
You know, and, you know, for me, with that Kyo business and that Kyo brand, being able to hand that over to the next generation would be success.
Mm.
That's success for me.
Do you see yourself then just as a custodian of the business as opposed to the business owner behind the business?
Yes, very much so. And there's definitely a responsibility there to give it off in a better way than you actually got it,
yeah.
You know. But at the same time, you also have to look at that next generation and it may not be the right thing for them. So, you know, I've seen plenty of situations whereby businesses have been handed over and it was the wrong thing to do, you know, and it destroyed kids, it destroyed a generation.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to make sure that the structures, the planning and everything is in place, that if that's going to happen, it happens in the right way.
When it comes to staff, are you a hire talent or develop from within?
When you're growing as fast as we're growing, you can't develop from within fast enough to keep up with the growth. So do you know what? Another thing I find with Ireland is in other countries, larger countries, you can hire very, very finite talent to do a certain job.
Mm.
Whereas in Ireland, we don't really have that. We don't have the pool here to allow that.
More generalists out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can hire somebody that's going to, you know, they're an expert in that certain machine and they can do that and they can develop that. You can do that in the UK.
Mm.
In Ireland, you can't. In Ireland, you have to be very, very loose around the role and you need to allow a lot of scope for people to actually develop. Yeah.
Mm. Do you obsess about the small things?
I used to.
Right.
Yeah, I used to. And I've learned not to. I think that whole term, you know, perfection gets in the way of greatness, mm-hmm. you know, is there's a huge weight in that to people who do. Naturally, I would be that perfectionist, but I can see now how I can get in my own way.
Yeah. Who do you seek advice from?
To be honest with you, very, very few people. If there's some, and this week there was a big heavy decision to be made. It's not made just yet, but to help steer me, I'll get my leadership team around the table. Right. Not all of them, but people that are relevant
can
in those areas.
To the decision.
Yeah. And then if there's, you know, if there's in-depth expertise required in certain areas. So for example, this week it was construction. I needed some real guidance around construction. Do I lease? Do I build? What's going on out there in the industry? What are the pricing, etc.? So I needed to reach out and get some advice back in on that. What's happened so we could make the right decision for the business. I didn't have that expertise within.
And what about the board? Is the board fully family or do you have outside?
It's no board.
No board?
No board. Oh, okay. You laugh, but it just slowed me down.
Right.
Yeah, and I've looked at it. A few people have come in and said it to me a few times over the years and it's like, okay, I just don't see how it could benefit us.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you think is the hardest part of the job as managing director or the boss, being the boss?
For me at this stage, it's keeping ahead of growth. Right. So I would hate to be in a way, I would hate to be hampering the growth and this business. Basically for me, I want this business to be the best that it can be, you know, and if I'm getting in the way of that, then I'll need to step aside. And the business is getting a bit too big now and the growth is too strong. Mm-hmm. And there, one of the things from my role within the business, I probably won't be managing director in the years to come. You know, I probably will need to repurpose myself or refine my role. And one of the things that we can see and is where we do lose out is that when your name is on every bag, consumers expect to see you.
Yeah.
You know, if we're having a big retail meeting in the States or in Australia or whatever it may be, they expect a family member to be in the room. And as I get busier and busier and busier, that's not happening. Mm. You know, so we've already identified we need to get, you know, other people in here to try help free my time up. Because at the end of the day,
the operational side off you and let you do the more, I wouldn't say ambassadorial, but there are those roles that are, there's a difference between being an entrepreneur and being a chief executive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And when you look at, so what are the competitive advantages in our business? Mm. So yeah, we're great quality, great consistency, packaging is amazing, you know, and we deliver. But one of our competitive advantages is the fact that there's a real people, real family behind our product. And you're not going to see that with most of our multinational customers. You will not see anybody there at that type, those type of people in their business. So a real advantage to us is that when somebody like me can walk into a room and have that meeting with the retailer and talk biz and make real decisions very, very quickly and move forward, that's hugely advantageous and advantageous. And we need to utilize that more.
Yeah. When you look at, you know, on a product by product basis is one thing, but when you look at the overall business, right, has fear of failure ever been a driving force for you?
No, not fear of failure. And we've failed with lots of stuff, but I just really enjoy trying new things. It's that give it a go attitude. I remember years ago, I'd a football manager in college, and he always used to say to us, lads, you miss every shot you don't take. You know, so just, you might kick a few wides, but just keep kicking.
How do you feel about what you've already done in the business?
It's you're not the first person to say this to me. God, you know, you guys have done amazing things. John, it never really has an effect on me. You know, and we've won these incredible awards, and the next morning you just get up and you go to work. It's been a success, but it never really enters your mind as, wow, look at this.
Does that mean then that you don't celebrate your wins?
Yeah, yeah.
And do you not think that's really sad?
We've started, like, and sorry, so separate me from the business. So the business, we celebrate our wins.
Right.
Yeah, and we're starting to do that an awful lot more.
Yeah.
Yeah, go out, get a bite to eat, have a few drinks. You know, we've done really well here. But me personally, I find it, I'll never give myself a tap on the back. I think I'm just too ambitious. Mm-hmm. It's always, okay, what's next? Mm-hmm. What's next? What's next? And that's good and bad.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I do think a lot of companies, I ask this question a lot for that exact reason. You get an awful lot of entrepreneurs who are just only ever looking forward, only ever focused on the forward. and you know, from time to time, and it's not about doing it regularly, but from time to time, you just sometimes it's really good idea to stop, look back and go, geez, we have done great. Okay, now let's move on, right? You recognize it, you might celebrate it, but you don't. It doesn't allow you to rest on your laurels or anything like that, but at least you've marked it.
Exactly, yeah. It doesn't, it's not as if, okay, this was the plan to get here.
Yeah.
You know, this, it's great. Okay, that's a nice bit of recognition. Yes, yeah. I remember, was it 2 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, we were awarded the overall Irish Exporter of the Year as a business. And we were up against, I wasn't even at the award ceremony. My son was sick at the time. And we were up against, you know, some of the biggest companies in this whole country. And we bet them and we got that award. And I remember at that time sitting down with the team the week later, says, this is just incredible. Mm. Like, I would have never, ever thought we would have even had any chance.
Yeah.
Getting an award like this in this business, but we did, you know, and it's great to get that recognition. It really is.
Yeah. How have personal experiences or development shaped your leadership style within the business?
I think the whole experience about being brought up in a family farm.
Yeah.
You know, where, you know, you worked hard, you broke it, you fixed it, and you learned every day. And that, when it came to, you know, developing my team, leading my team, it's never okay, you go do that job. Mm. It's always a shoulder to shoulder approach. You know, we're in this together. This is where we're going. And I think that's a hugely valuable approach to take. And I've never tried to do that. Mm-hmm. And I can see it now today, and it took me years to realize this. It's just how we were brought up.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't that, you know, you went and told people to do a job. Mm. You know, they'd go and do the job, but you're almost in it with them, you know, and bringing everybody forward, you know, so that's definitely helped.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in that way, then, would it be a deeply traumatic experience for you in the years to come if you could not be back on the shop floor, right? Getting back down and getting into the tractor or going to the thing. Like, if it got to the point where you were stuck in an ivory office and all you ever saw was spreadsheets.
Yeah. No, definitely don't want that. And back to your point about the development and the managing directors. That's one of the things why I'm saying that, you know, in a few years, I don't think I'll be in that role is because I really enjoy being in the weeds, you know, and people at my level in business doing my role, you know, they shouldn't be in the weeds.
Yeah.
And we all know we shouldn't be in the weeds. I actually really like that, you know, so I need to give myself time to do that.
Yeah. Do you hate winning or love losing? Do you hate losing or love winning?
That's a strange question, isn't it? Yeah. Isn't love winning? I don't like losing.
Right.
Yeah. I don't like losing. And but at the same time, I really enjoy being the underdog.
Right.
And in our position as, you know, small to medium sized family business operating in a global snack food industry, in all these different countries, we're always up against these colossal businesses that could just flick us like a fly if they wanted to. So that challenge, being the underdog and going in and, you know, trying to get that market share from these huge businesses. I find that hugely enjoyable.
But you also have the big benefit you have over them is an agility to just you know, bob and weave, where, as you said earlier on, you don't have to go through 15 layers of management to see can we make a shamrock flavoured crisp, right, for St. Patrick's Day.
But that bob and weave agility, just in my experience over time, businesses that have that, sometimes they don't use it.
Yeah.
Because they just haven't got that strategic approach around be agile. You know, fail fast, fail quick, move on, make that decision. They don't. They just tend to just choke themselves. Mm. Even though they have the complete capability to be agile, they end up just...
But almost afraid of the agility.
Yeah.
You know, that they can go, oh, we couldn't do that. You know, all the management books are telling us that's the last thing you should be doing. You know, when it's probably the one secret sauce that they actually have as a small company against a big company is the agility.
Yeah, exactly. And I see, like, we be approached quite regularly by a lot of food startups, especially looking for advice and et cetera. And these, I can see a lot of startups nowadays, they will wrap themselves up in so much tape with funding and this fund and that fund and everything before they've even made anything. They're just completely have choked the business just to try to get the funding sorted.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, a lot to be said, just keep it simple.
And in that way then, what advice would you give to young people today? Career advice, life advice, any sort of advice?
I think looking into the future, there is going to be an incredible shortage of manual jobs, people to do those jobs. I can see it already. Mm. Every builder I know has just won't answer the phone anymore. Yeah. So I think trades are going to be huge in the future. AI is not going to take away from that.
AI can't grow a potato.
Can't grow a potato. But that, I suppose that leads on to another point, and this is really important. There is a quiet crisis happening, and there is nobody young, very, very few people young, coming into the agricultural industry at a young age, and especially around fruit and vegetable production. If I was to get a list of all the potato growers in this country between the ages of 25 and 35, I probably wouldn't make a football team.
Right.
It's really scary. And the average age of those potato growers in Ireland at the moment, I'd guess 62, 63.
It's a real risk that knowledge base disappears.
To be honest with you, we're probably beyond that already. I'm just really concerned where our food is going to come from in two generations. They're not there. The kids are not there. They're not being incentivized to be there. And I think at a government level in this country, we really need to rethink the whole approach to that. You know, take France, for example. In France, a young farmer can actually buy land at a competitive rate that will allow them to produce food. Whereas in Ireland, who could afford to buy land? No farmer can afford to buy land in Ireland to produce food on.
Mm, no chance.
25 to 30,000 an acre? Mm. Not a hope in hell. Yeah. So this whole thing needs to be relooked. And from a government level, I think all our focus tends to go on meat and dairy.
Yeah,
because, you know, they're the big two sectors, meat and dairy. We're going to lose food security around vegetables and fruit in this country if we don't do something really, really quick. Really quick. So advice to a young person looking to get into agriculture, I think there's going to be massive opportunity, but there's also massive challenges there at the moment.
Right. Come to the black book time. Let's see what you have. Oh, interesting. It's interesting who was actually asked this question anyway, but I
you're not going to tell me who asked, no?
No, I can't tell you. What was the biggest mistake you ever made in business, and how valuable were the learnings?
Oh, God, that's a hard one, isn't it? The biggest mistake I ever made. Listen, we've made lots and lots of mistakes. It's hard to say what the biggest one is. Going after the UK market and investing in that market to a point that we were losing money, you know, with every bag that was sold there, and trying to chase the bigger, the light at the end of the tunnel, which was the bigger volume play. I probably lost 3 years in that. Whereas in the UK market, it's very competitive, and that little bit of water between Ireland and England actually can cost a lot of money.
Mm.
And we found it really difficult to make things work over there. And, you know, eventually today we don't deal in the UK at all. It's more profitable for me to send product to Australia than it is to send it into the UK, which is incredible to think. But the UK, it's quite difficult to make that work in our sector. But I chased it. I probably chased it for too long and lost money on the way.
And time.
Yeah. Exactly. That time could be far better invested in other markets and other places. Mm-hmm. So that's probably a mistake I made and a mistake we learned from. Mm. Yeah, we don't deal there at all today. Yeah.
Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Tom Keogh. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe, or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks, and we will see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy, and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.